Well, it's already been an exciting morning. This morning has already been better than football last night for me. I don't want to talk about it. I told myself I wasn't going to say anything. It's a good thing that we gather to celebrate Jesus and not football. Unless you're a Gator fan, then you're happy today. But, oh man, for Miami fans, it's a rough morning. Well, we finished our series on missional meals with Jesus, and we are now starting our new series on the book of Philippians. So congratulations, you were at the opening first week where we look at the book of Philippians, and I'm actually really, really excited about this. When I first started praying about the book of Philippians, the main reason I was jumping into Philippians is because I kept seeing these commands to rejoice. Like, he kept saying these things to rejoice, and I was like, I am just not rejoicing. Not enough. I'm not doing this. Like, I can get knocked off of rejoicing so quickly. And so as I started jumping into Philippians, I was excited about it. And honestly, part of it was just because I felt like I needed to be challenged with how to rejoice in Jesus more. But then as I got into it this week, in my preparation for this the last couple weeks, I've read through Philippians 4 or 5 times, just trying to sit down and read it in one sitting to get an idea of what Paul was trying to say. And I got really excited about not just about what he was saying to my heart, but the timeliness of what I think our church needs to hear in this. So let me tell you a little bit about Philippians before we jump in. Now, if you're a history buff, this makes you happy. If you don't like history, can you just bear with me for like 2 minutes, and then we'll get into the start of Philippians. So let me tell you what's kind of going on. The Apostle Paul is writing this letter to a church in Philippi. That's the name of the city. And Philippi, Paul is writing from a prison cell. So here's what that means. He's sitting in jail, and he's writing a letter to them saying, I need you to rejoice in everything. Does that sound audacious to anyone else? Like it sounds psychotic. It sounds stupid. It sounds fake, if I'm honest. But here's Paul sitting probably in a Roman prison, although there's some debate about that, but I feel fairly certain that he's in Rome, and he's in this Roman prison, not sure if he's going to get executed or not, and he's writing to out of concern for the church in Philippi, and the Philippians had heard that Paul was in prison in Rome, and so they sent this guy named Epaphroditus to Rome with money to help meet Paul's needs, and so Epaphroditus shows up, and he gets super sick to the point they think he's going to die, and they have to walk and write letters, so Philippi hears about this. Epaphroditus is sick, the guy you sent. He might die. Like, they're hearing about this. They're worried. So Paul is writing the letter to the Philippians to tell them, thank you for the gift. Epaphroditus is better. And he's also heard there's been some fighting in the church. Like this church has some fights that is happening. They've got some persecution and pressure that's happening. And so he's writing to this church as they're in conflict and they're suffering. They're fighting with each other. There's people trying to kill them and pressure them. And so Paul writes this letter to the Philippians, and there's a few big ideas in the book of Philippians. The first main idea is unity. Like you're going to see the idea of unity popping up over and over and over again in the book of Philippians. He tells them repeatedly, please get along. Please be unified. Please be of one mind. Then you're also going to see him talk about enduring and rejoicing in suffering. Like for real suffering, not the I broke my nail or I got a flat tire suffering. I mean like the real type of suffering where there's oppression and injustice and the type of things where you don't know what's going to happen to you and your family because of your faith. And he's writing to them saying, listen, we don't just survive this, we endure it, and we endure it with joy and rejoicing. It's phenomenal, man. And that's what he's going to talk about in the book of Philippians. So I think that we're going to see gospel unity and gospel suffering in the book of Philippians. You're going to see this constant thing happening where they're unified around the gospel, not around football, not around a building, not around preferences. They're unified around the gospel of Jesus Christ. And you're also going to see this thing. There's this gospel joy that happens in suffering. It's better than suffering. It trumps suffering. It makes suffering bearable because of the gospel work of Jesus, because of the promises that he said he's going to do. So that's kind of, that's a spoiler alert. I've already given you a spoiler alert for all of the book of Philippians. So you can skip the next 10 weeks. I'm just kidding. Don't, Please don't do that. Anyways, but let's. What I want to do today is we're not going to actually be in Philippians. We're going to go to Acts chapter 16, and we're going to look at the start of the book of Philippians, because I want us to take a look at the context. Like, what is this church that Paul is writing to? It's really helpful to know. It's a very personal letter in the book of Philippians. So let's find out what these people are like. So flip with me to Acts chapter 16, and we're going to start in verse 11. And you've got Paul and Silas and Luke, and I think there's some other people in there. And here's what happens in verse 11. So setting sail from Troas, we made a direct voyage to Samothrace. I don't even know how to say that. Every time I tried to practice it, I just did what I just did. And the following day, they went to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city in the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. Let me hit pause. So just so you know, this is somewhere in Greece. That's where Macedonia is. And Philippi it's a leading city in this region of that area. It's actually a Roman colony, which is a big deal for Philippians. Here's what that means. That means if you were a Philippian citizen, you had all the rights of a person that lived in the Roman provinces. You were a citizen. You had all the same laws and all the same protection. Like, this is a very big deal for Philippi. It's very rare to have that. It's like being a U.S. citizen in the middle of a communist country, okay? Like you get to be a citizen. If somehow we conquered, I shouldn't say China, that's too explosive of a, we conquered some country and we said, listen, we're going to set up shop and all of you are conquered, but people in this city and people in that certain city, you all get to be American citizens. Like, if you're in this city, you're a citizen, you have all the rights of an American citizen in the middle of this country. Like, it would be a big deal to be in that city. It's a place where a ton of Roman soldiers would go and retire. That's where they would show up. It was a city filled with veterans. So they had high nationalistic pride about Rome and Italy and the greatness of Rome and the entire empire. And they were all citizens. So they loved being Romans. So here Paul shows up, and he shows up in Philippi, a major city. And here's what he does in verse 13. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to the riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer. And we sat down and spoke to the women who had come together. So what Paul normally does is he shows up in a Jewish synagogue because they know the Old Testament Bible. They know about the Messiah. So he goes to the people that are closest to understanding the gospel. And when he shows up in Philippi, there's not a Jewish synagogue because there's not enough Jewish men. You have to have at least 10 Jewish men to set up a synagogue in the ancient days, and they didn't have that. They might have had zero men. So Paul's looking for the group of people that know the Old Testament scriptures, and he finds this group of women that go out to pray every Saturday. And he shows up over there, and he bumps into them, and he meets them, and here's what he does. He starts speaking the gospel to them. Look at verse 14. This is phenomenal, okay? This is his first couple days of church planting in Philippi. Like, we're like 3 days in. Verse 14. And one who heard us was a woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple goods, who was a worshiper of God. And look at what happens here as Paul's proclaiming the gospel. The Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. Like, listen, this is great right here, right? So Paul shows up. It's like day three in the city. And right out of the gate, he goes to this group of ladies who are getting together to pray. And he shares the gospel and says this amazing thing. Lydia gets saved, you guys. Like, and this is a great first day of church planting. And this isn't just any normal person. So she's a seller of purple. So here's Lydia. Here's what this means. Back in this time, it wasn't that purple was just your favorite color. Purple was the color of royalty. And it was expensive. So her customers were the financial elite in Philippi. I mean, like, the rich of the rich. They're dealing with presidents and senators and congressmen. Like, they're dealing with the most rich people in the world at that time. That's Lydia's customer base. She's probably wealthy. She's influential. She's powerful. And out of the gate, she gets saved. Like, so now, listen, if this is your first day of church planting, she becomes their donor, their supporter. Look at what she says here in verse 15. Then after she was baptized and her household as well, she led her whole household to the Lord. She urged us, saying, if you've judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. She prevailed upon us. So she's got this huge house that can house these four or five men that are with them. Now, listen, you've got a killer church started right there. Like, here's Paul. He's got financial backing so he can have a building and get his staff together or whatever they did. That's not what they did at all back then, right? Like, he has a place to stay, and what he's going to do is he's going to start proclaiming the gospel in the city. And he just got access to the elite of the elite in Philippi and maybe even in Rome, because she's a seller of purple. She's a rich, influential businesswoman. And here's what I want to encourage you on real quick. It's that verse that we saw right there in verse 14, that the Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. Church, I just want to encourage you for a moment. This is an awesome phrase, because this is exactly how the gospel works. The gospel works like this. Someone proclaims the good news of Jesus Christ, that he died on the cross for our sins, that he was buried, that he came back to life 3 days later. And if you just place your trust in him, he will save you. Someone proclaims that good news, and then God does a work in your heart that something starts to happen, right? Like, something starts to say, you know what, I need to hear this. I need to get this. I need to believe this. And after that happens, then you get saved. You place your trust in Jesus, and he makes you his son or daughter. Like, here's why that's good news for us, church. Let me ask you a question. The moment you got saved, how many times do you think it's normally the first time that you hear the gospel? I think many times, for many of us, we've heard the gospel over and over and over again, right? Like, think about children that get saved. They've possibly heard it every Sunday for 6 or 7 or 8 years. And then finally, what happens as they hear it one day? Right? They're saying, you know what, it's different. It's not just to please mommy and daddy. It's not pressure. Like, there's something real that's happening. And we say, dude, wait a second. Like, something's happening. The Lord's doing this work that's causing them to pay attention. It's awesome. Or think about what's happened for you. How many times did you hear the gospel, and then all of a sudden, that moment that you get saved, what was happening in you when you heard the gospel that time? It wasn't a different message, was it? It was the same message. Do you know what was powerful about it? It was the work of Jesus Christ that started to stir your heart in that moment, and all of a sudden, he's helping you pay attention in a way you've never paid attention before, and then you place your trust in Jesus, and you get saved. Like, it's this phenomenal moment for us, church. And here's why that's good news for me. Here's why I think this is good news. Romans chapter 1, verse 16 says this. Look at this verse that's going to be up on the screen. It says this: I am not ashamed of the gospel. Why? Why is Paul not ashamed of this thing? For it is the power of God for salvation for everyone who believes. See what he just said right there? I'm not embarrassed of the gospel because it's the power of God to save people. Church, here's what I want you to know. God is the power behind the good news of the gospel. And he doesn't need my help to make it more powerful. You notice that Paul didn't have a phenomenal illustration. He didn't say, listen, there's this rich lady. I've got this illustration that's killer. It's really going to zing her. She's going to probably be crying. It's going to be great. Do you know why? He just shared the good news. There was no magic bullet illustration. There was no phenomenal question that he records in Acts here. It just says he shared the good news. And what's happening? God is working. Like, he didn't have to have a band behind him. He didn't say, Silas, I need you to play a couple verses for me right now, because I need you to set the mood, because if you don't do that, God won't work in her heart. No, that's not at all what was happening. Like, what was happening is Paul's proclaiming the gospel, and there was no manipulation. He didn't have a relationship with this lady. He knew nothing about her. He didn't have 5 years of friendship where he was hanging out with her and inviting her over to his house for dinner. Like, it was their first meeting, and he proclaims the gospel, and what happens? God works in her heart. Church, I just want to tell you, when you proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, you're exposing people to the power of God. Like, that's a tremendous relief for me. Do you know why? You ever try to share the gospel with a friend and you stumble on it? Or you ever try to get up and preach and stumble through it? You know what's real easy to do? Listen, if I could communicate better, if I had better illustrations or better stories, if I really knew how to draw the net, if I could just work the crowd a little bit better, maybe the gospel would be more effective. Listen, it's to our shame that churches work like this too often. We would never say it, but we don't feel that the raw, plain, simple gospel is actually powerful. So we feel like we have to dress it up. We have to strengthen it and prop it up. There's got to be certain music in a certain building and a certain ambiance and a certain setting. I've got to be their friends for 5, 10, 15 years before I can even broach the subject. I need all the questions and all the outlines and all the formulas. And I need a great story about someone dying in a car accident suddenly and then going to hell. And then they wake up and then I can really, really get them that way. Like, listen, church. The gospel is the power of God, and if you stumble through it, and if you're weak, and if you're frail, and you have bad illustrations, you don't have to be perfect, because the power is not in your presentation. It's in His work. So listen, church, I want you to have boldness, not in your ability, but in His ability to do a work. I want you to feel free to share the gospel with your friends and your coworkers and your neighbors. Like, don't be a jerk about it. I'm not telling you not to be wise. I'm telling you the gospel is the power. The gospel is the power of God. And I'm praying that He would free us up to be a people that aren't locked into these things that we think make the gospel more powerful. Like, because here's what I think, church. Here's why we've been doing missional meals all summer long. Because I believe that when you place your trust in Jesus, He puts His Spirit in you. Like His real and powerful Spirit. Regardless of your past, regardless of your history, regardless of your education, doesn't matter. Because you become His son and daughter and He places His Spirit in you. Then you have the gospel, which is the power of God, the salvation. I don't have the soul market in this church on the Spirit or on the gospel. He's given it to every single person in this room. So why would I try to get you to lessen that power and say they have to come and hear Faez preach a message or they're not going to get saved? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. What makes sense to me is if all of you have the same Spirit that I do, the exact same Spirit, if we all have the same exact Holy Spirit as the Apostle Paul, why would I make you just sit and listen to me do all the work? When I can release you on this city and people who need the good news. If you have the same gospel message as I do, why would it just be me proclaiming the gospel? Church, God has given you access all over the place, and it is my job to equip you and encourage you to go out in faith in His Spirit and His message to give you everything you need to be an effective witness for the gospel of Jesus Christ. You don't need me holding your hand. You don't need me doing it for you. You need the Spirit holding your hand. You need the gospel doing the work for you. And you have it. You have it. Church, I want you to believe that. And when you feel timid, or when you blow it and you don't speak up, or when you stumble, you don't get it quite right, I want you to walk away and say, hey, Jesus, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God. I am not the power of God. His message is. And me on my own is weak and frail, but He gets more glory when that happens. Listen, if you've ever seen Billy Graham preach, any here ever seen him on TV? Anybody live? I don't know how many of y'all, some of y'all live. Listen, one of the things you're going to notice is, I mean, he's awesome. I don't want to, like, take away from the awesomeness of Billy Graham, but his message is pretty basic, isn't it? I mean, it's not this thing where it's like, dude, that was, whoa. I've never heard this before. Like if you're a Christian, you show up to a Billy Graham crusade, like you could probably tell the story possibly just as good as he does. It's the gospel. That's the power of God. So church, can we believe that? Like, will we really believe that this week on your lunch break with your unsaved friends? Will you really believe it this next weekend when you have some unsaved friends come over to watch football? Will you really believe that the gospel is the power of God to salvation? Will you feel free that the moment you speak that gospel truth, you know what you've done in that moment?
You've brought the power of God into the situation. You have the opportunity to bring the power of God to bear on someone's life that has not encountered him yet by speaking the gospel. So listen, when you engage, I don't want you to do it in faith in your ability. I don't want you to do it in faith in your training. I want you to do it in faith in the power of God. Listen, man, if he can bring a man back from the dead and he can kill sin in me, like if he can actually do that, if he can make me his son, then listen, he can save anyone, right? I mean, like if he can fix this mess, dude, he can fix my neighbors. And he can use you. Like that's how strong he is. Stop believing in a weak God that only works in a few. He's there in all of us. Okay, that was a side sermon. Let me jump back into the start of Acts. So here's the start of this church. Lydia gets saved, and now his church is full of rich people, okay? Like, he has rich people, and he has access to rich people. Like, this is the high life of church planting. Like, this is going to Wall Street and planting, and all of a sudden, your church is full of bankers. Like, dude, this is killer, all right? Like, this is every church planter's dream. What do you want to do, Paul? Well, let's look and see what happens next. Verse 16. So the next week, as we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners much gain by fortune telling. Like this poor slave girl, so we find out very quickly, she's owned by people. She's suffering injustice and oppression. And to make matters worse, she's possessed by a demon. The word it has, it literally from the Greek means a spirit of Python, like the snake, which is supposed to be the prophet of Apollos. So one ancient historian described them as ventriloquists. That's what these people were, because a demon would take over and treat them like a puppet, and they would just start saying things that came from the demon. So here's this girl. She's oppressed by people, and she's tormented by demons. And she shows up at this place of prayer. Listen, this girl does not fit in with Lydia. Like, this is an awkward church service. Can we just be honest? Like, this is really awkward. We're in week two, and we've already got this poor, suffering, oppressed, but demonic slave girl. Like, who knows what this girl has experienced to get to this point? And so her owners would make money off of her. Like, they'd make money because she'd be able to give people insight. And they would pay lots of money because they're going to get insight from supernatural things. Like listen, I don't know how else to describe this. It's a little crass, but this is, they're using this girl. This is like she's in prostitution. Like, she's abused and oppressed and owned. And people are getting rich and she's getting poorer. And there's no way out for this girl. So she starts following around Paul. Look at verse 17. So she followed around Paul and us, and she's crying out, "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." Now listen, I got to be honest with you. I have no idea what's happening in this moment. I don't know why a demon-possessed girl would have a demon saying, "Let's tell everyone these guys are messengers from God and they've got good news for them." I don't get it. I tried to figure it out, and everything was just a guess. But all I know is this, is she's walking around giving free advertising, probably not the best advertising, but she's giving free advertising for Paul and Silas. These guys are servants of the Most High. They're telling you the way of salvation. And she's doing it day after day after day. And I don't know why Paul waited so long. Maybe it took him a while to figure out that she was demon-possessed. I don't know. But look at what he does in verse 18. "And this she kept doing for many days. And Paul, having become greatly annoyed." By the way, that's really encouraging to me. All right? Like, yes, Paul got annoyed. Finally, I have proof that he was human. Okay, so Paul is just irritated out of his brain. Like, this girl, like, I'm talking, she's interrupting me, she's causing a scene. Like, we're trying to have church in here, and this girl's acting like a lunatic every single time we gather together. So he just gets annoyed, and he turned, and he said to the Spirit, now this irritation turned into something unbelievable, right? He turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out that very hour. Dude, week two of church planning for Paul is ridiculous. Like, what? Week one, bankers. Week two, like literally, we're just many days, maybe 6 or 7 days. Maybe it's week three, I don't know. In the middle of the church service, he casts out a demon out of this demon-possessed girl. Like, listen, I don't know what you're used to, but if that's my first 2 weeks at a church, good grief. Like, my first 2 weeks here were boring, man. Like, we didn't do anything. Nothing. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And here's Paul, and it's the gospel at work. And this girl that had suffered a lot, that was used by everyone, and no one seemed to care that she was a human being. In this moment, she gets freedom like she's never known. Like the gospel at work. Like it's church, this type of thing should make us so happy. Listen, the heartbeat of Jesus for his church is to find the oppressed and free them. That's the heartbeat. And it's not just spiritual oppression that they care about. It's not like Paul just said, listen, I'm so glad we cast that demon out. Good luck with all your hopes and dreams in slavery. Like, listen, it never stopped there for any of them in the New Testament. Never stop there. It's this phenomenal thing that the church cares about the physical needs and the spiritual needs. And if we're going to be accurate representation of Jesus Christ, we have to care about all oppression and injustice, even if we're not the ones that are victims of it. And here the gospel comes to light in this moment. And this girl, She's freed spiritually. We don't know what happens to her, but we know this. Her masters get real upset. Like I said, they didn't care about this girl. This girl was property. This girl was income. And Paul just jacked it all up. Like, she can't do it anymore. Look at what happens in verse 19. But when her owners saw that their hope of gain, they saw that their profit had stopped from this girl. Listen, if they did this to Paul and Silas, I feel awful for what happened for this poor girl, but we don't know. But they seized Paul and Silas, and they dragged them into the marketplace before the rulers. Like, listen, do you realize how ridiculous this is? A girl that was possessed by a demon gets freed, and people are mad about it. Like, the culture is so warped in Philippi that a human being can be owned and used, and people aren't upset until she can't be used anymore. Then they're mad. Because what happened is Paul just messed with their pocketbook, and he messed with status quo. They don't care about that girl as long as she's making money, but when Paul messes with it and their pocketbook gets hit, it's game on now. So they go and they grab them, they seize them, they drag them into the marketplace before the rulers. And let me hit pause real quick. Paul is a Roman citizen. And remember, Philippi, they're all Roman citizens in Philippi, right? There's a couple rules about Roman citizens. Here's one of the rules. You don't get to imprison me and throw me in jail and beat me until I've had a fair trial. But that ain't happening right here. Look at what happens to Paul and Silas. Verse 20, when they brought them to the magistrates, they said, these men are Jews. Apparently they didn't like Jews very much in the city. And they're disrupting our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice. Now listen, Paul and Silas don't get to say a word. The crowd joined in attacking them. So they all start saying, boo, like they're all saying, get rid of him, finish him off, the whole crowd. We've got a lynch mob raising up here. And here's what the magistrates do. They take them, they're afraid they're disturbing their city. Verse 22, the magistrates tore the garments off of them. They took Paul and Silas and they ripped their robes off. So they're standing there in their underwear. And they gave orders to beat them with rods. Listen, this isn't the Jew thing where there's a certain number. They just said, beat them. They beat them until they were done beating them. They did not get 39 lashes. They got beaten until they were done being beaten. Verse 23, when they had inflicted many blows upon them,
They threw them into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. In verse 24, and having received this order, he put them into the inner prison, like the nasty cells in the deep, deep, deep prison. And he fastened their feet in the stocks. Like this wasn't just to keep them secure. The stocks were also used to torture people. So they'd be these wooden beams that had several leg holes, and they would spread them apart to further apart to make you more uncomfortable. They'd put your feet up on the wall to try to get your legs to cramp. So here's Paul and Silas. No trial. None. No chance to stop it. And they get the snot, literally, they get the snot beaten out of them. For what? Rescuing an oppressed girl. For sharing the gospel. The good news of Jesus Christ gets them beaten senseless. And I imagine they were bruised and bleeding. Their backs, their ribs, their arms, their face, their head, their legs, all of them beat with rods by a mob. Then dragged into a prison cell, a filthy, dark, disgusting cell without toilets. Why does that matter? Because their bloody backs are laying on that filthy prison floor. And their feet are up in the stocks, and their legs are probably cramping. No bandages, no medicine, just laying there waiting to see what's going to happen. And so here's my question for you. That happens to you. What are you thinking in that moment? You angry? Maybe angry? Maybe the thing that's going on in your head is, this is so unfair. It's unjust. I'm a citizen of the United States of America. You can't throw me in prison right now. I'm innocent. I didn't even get a trial. Confused? Maybe it's not anger. Maybe your question is, I'm confused. God, I was trying to please you. Help me understand, like, why? Why am I being so oppressed right now? Where are you at? I mean, I'm just serving you. I thought you were strong and you defended the weak. And where are you, God? Maybe you're angry, maybe you're confused, or maybe you're scared, right? Like, listen, I don't know how I made that out of it alive, and I don't know what tomorrow brings. I don't know if we get out of here. I don't know if they take us and kill us. Whatever you're feeling, I want you to see what happens in verse 25. About midnight, I imagine it took them several hours to work through everything, but about midnight, Paul and Silas, they were praying and singing hymns to God. What kind of psychopaths respond like that? Okay, let's do lesser. You drive to work tomorrow, and your car breaks down. How long before you start praying and singing praises to God? You show up to work late, and your car just broke down, and your boss is in a cranky mood, so he fires you for being late. How long before you're praying and singing praises to God? You go home, and you tell your wife the bad news. I just lost my job and the car's broken. I don't know how we're going to fix this thing. Like, listen, it's stacking up, right? Your wife is mad, but you found that she went to the doctor and she got a really bad diagnosis. Maybe cancer. This is all make-believe, so just go with me. How long before you're praying and singing praises to God? Church, whatever the circumstance, when you see that, that doesn't look right, does it? Like, if someone actually responded this way, that tragedy strikes, injustice strikes, they're sick and they're wounded, they don't know what's going to happen next, and their response is to pray and sing praises to God. Either they are psychopaths who are crazy and have a mental illness, or there's some type of powerful work of God that's happening in their heart that trumps all circumstances. Listen, I think they're not crazy. I think they were in their right mind, and I think it was shockingly amazing to everyone around them. Let me show you why. Look at the rest of that verse. And the prisoners were listening to them. Now, I'm sure those prisoners heard a whole lot of things as people got dragged into that, into their cells. And I'm sure singing praises to God and praying was not something they had seen before. I'm sure they'd seen crazy. I'm sure they'd seen angry. I'm sure they'd seen scared. I'm sure they'd seen confused. They'd seen it all, but they hadn't seen worship as a response to injustice. And look at what happens. Verse 26. And suddenly, listen, the way God works is phenomenal. And suddenly there was a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately, I don't know what kind of earthquake this is, but it opens all the prison doors and everyone's chains fall off. Like, apparently God knew the frequency for that. He just said, wha-bam, like turns the dial up, earthquake, doors open, nothing collapses, doors open, chains fall off. Now, what do you do if you're a prisoner and all the doors open, it's the middle of the night, and all the chains drop off? What do you go for? Freedom. Right? Like, that is a no-brainer, especially if you've got a really bad sentence. The thing you go for is you go for freedom, and you get out of Philippi. Like, I'm going somewhere else, man. I'm going to Rome. I'm going somewhere, but I am not staying in Philippi. This is my chance. God has been kind to me. He opened the doors. He sent an earthquake. He dropped all the chains off. I'm out of here, man. And you take off. What would keep you from taking off? Maybe fear. But I don't think fear is what motivated these guys. Look at what happens next. Verse 27, when the jailer woke, you would think an earthquake would do that, just for the record. The jailer woke and he saw that the prison doors were open. That's a nervous moment, okay? Just if you're a prison guard and you're asleep, earthquake, you wake up, you light a torch, you open up, all the doors are open, you're there by yourself. This is a bad moment, guys. This is a real bad moment. And just so you know, this guy was probably a retired Roman soldier. That's how he got this job. I mean, his specialty is beating prisoners and handling situations like this. But here's what he knows. When those guys get out, I get their consequences. This is a death sentence for me. For every prisoner that escapes, I'm paying the price. And so he goes in and he sees that all the doors are open. So what does he do? He drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." Listen, prisoners don't hear crazy and then all the doors open and run to go see crazy. Prisoners run away from freedom when there's something better in the cell next door. Listen, these prisoners heard them praying and praising a God, and it had such a powerful impact on these prisoners that if they had to choose between freedom and escape or going in the cell and finding out the good news of Paul and Silas, every single one of them chose the cell. Man, I gotta be honest with you. Church worship is weak compared to that. Like, seriously? Like, you mess with worship, it's strong enough to make people angry, right? But is it strong enough to cause someone that doesn't know God to say, "I gotta find out what that is"? Not in most of the churches I've been in. Is there anything about our worship when we gather together that makes people want more? Or does it communicate something else? Does it communicate they don't mean it? They don't believe it? This is just routine? Listen, I'm not trying to make you sing louder because people are watching. That's not the game plan. But the challenge here is, here's these men that are authentically praying and worshiping God, and it was so powerful, people wanted to hear the good news. Man, that's awesome. And so listen to what this guy does. So here's what he does. Verse 29, the jailer called for the lights, and he rushed in. and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas, and he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Like, here's this hardened ex-veteran military guy from a Roman guard. He's a prison guard, and he's shaking in his boots saying, "Man, you got to tell me, man, how do I get this? How do I get saved?" And they tell him the good news. It's simple. They said, verse 31, "Believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who were in his house. So this dude takes the prisoners out of their cells and takes them to his house. Listen, ladies, if your husband worked in the prison system, can we be honest for a moment? And he sneaks him out one night and says, "You got to meet this dude. We're having dinner with him." Is anyone else like a little nervous about this message? Is my son, like, what's going on with this guy? Like, you're scared in your mind. But Paul and Silas show up and the message is so powerful, it overcomes all of that bias. And their whole family gets saved, man. Like, it's awesome. Verse 33. "And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds, and he was baptized at once, he and all his family." And then he takes them back to jail. That's a whole other story. But listen to this. Just think about this church, okay? What are Paul's two main messages to the church in Philippi? Unity and rejoicing in suffering. Listen, that church is made up of a rich businesswoman, a slave girl, a prison guard and his family, and convicts. Paul did not make four separate churches in Philippi. He didn't say, "Listen, this won't work. This won't work. Like, there is no way that we can overcome all these differences. I need a rich people church right over here. Lydia, get your buddies, because you know how to reach rich people. We're going to gather in a nice, pretty, clean-smelling space where everyone is dressed the same and has the same type of income and the same likes and the same backgrounds, right? And we need a slave church. Okay, so we get this. We need something where all the slaves can get together and they can worship how slaves are. I can't put you with the rich people. That's not going to work. I mean, they're not equals with slaves. That's not going to work at all. This awkward moment. No, we can't do that. Oh, man, now I've got prisoners and a prison warden. I definitely can't put those two groups together, right? Do I put this guy with the rich people? No, can't do that. Can't put him with the slaves. You know what? I need a prison warden. I need a veteran church, right? I need all my military. We have a military church, like, because there's a certain thing they need. They speak the same language. They got the same benefits. They have war stories they can share. They got to be together. And you know what? Over here, this is where I put the convicts. Because I can't put them with the slaves. I know that. Definitely not Lydia. That's going to be awkward and uncomfortable. I can't have them going to her house for dinner. Like, that's going to be, there's no way her rich friends put up with that. Neither does Lydia. She takes off. These four have to stay separate. That is not at all what Paul does. They are all together in one church. Talk about stupid. Or is it? How does that work? Listen, it doesn't unless Jesus really died on the cross and he really came back from the dead and he really makes us brothers and sisters, and that thing that he changes about us, our identity, he changes us so fundamentally, it trumps our income, it trumps our socioeconomic status, it trumps our past, it trumps our sins and our convictions. It trumps it all, because the most fundamental thing about you is that you are in Jesus Christ. Do we believe that? Listen, I wonder sometimes. I wonder, is the gospel strong enough to make us diverse and like it? Is it strong enough? Well, I mean, Paul's going to write to them saying, listen, you need to consider others as more important than yourself.
Lydia, rich elite businesswoman, had to look at slaves, middle class jailer, convicts, as more important than her and give up her preferences for them. You know what does that? The gospel. If God can bring a man back from the dead, then he can unite those groups of people. And if he can't, then this gospel's a fraud. And I think our churches in the United States and all over the South scream fraud. And it's not okay. It isn't. And I think Philippians addresses this issue. I think it also says something else. Listen, can you imagine something with me? And listen, I know I'm meddling with stuff, so I want to be careful here. But I'm going to go there anyways because we need to hear it. So he's talking about unity. He talks about rejoicing in suffering. Like, listen, it's really easy to say you need to be happy about what you're going through. But half this church joined the church because they actually saw Paul and Silas rejoice in suffering and injustice. It's an outlandish command that he's going to tell them in Philippians. But here's what I want you to imagine. Can you imagine this scene in the jail? Paul and Silas have been beaten. They're hanging upside down. They're like, man, let's pray. So they pray. Hey, let's sing a song to God. Hey, Silas, what do you want to sing? Oh, listen, I really like it when we sing this really modern song. I mean, I think they just wrote it like 60 AD. It's phenomenal. Like, this thing, like, it's cutting edge. Let's sing this song. And Paul says, what? You crazy? Listen, there are ancient Jewish psalms that are 1,000 years old. That modern stuff, that's crap. Give me the good stuff, the solid. Give me Psalms 1 and Psalm 2 and Psalm 3 and Psalm 4. Can you imagine if they got in a fight about music preferences in that jail cell? Seems kind of stupid, doesn't it? Can you imagine how rude it would be for Silas to look at Paul and say, listen here, old man, you need to get with the times, or I'm not going on the next trip with you. I'm going to start my young, hip little mission trip. Can you imagine how arrogant and unloving it would have been if Paul would have said, listen here, young man, I've put in my time. I'm Paul. You get with my program or you hit the road and you aren't coming with me. You can go start a trip somewhere else. But this is my trip with my music and you sing it the way I want. Remember how I said I needed to be careful? Can y'all feel that tension right there? Yeah, me too. Church, worship is about Jesus. Worship is about Jesus. And either he is good enough to worship no matter the style or he isn't. And when we fight about those things, listen, you're allowed to have opinions. I'm not saying that. You're allowed to say, man, I really like the hymns. So do I. They're awesome. That's why we sing hymns. You're allowed to say, man, I really love the praise songs. That's great. That's awesome. I love singing the praise songs. But it isn't about you. It's not about me. Worship is about Jesus. And one of the reasons I believe churches in the United States are crippled and weak and anemic and making no real impact is because it's all about us. Church, is Jesus better than that? Like, here's what I want to lead you. Man, I'm nervous about this because we are in the middle of a worship transition right now. I don't know if you knew. I actually know that. I don't know if y'all knew that or not. I actually know that we're in a worship transition. We're there, right? And it feels uncomfortable. Wait, does anyone else feel uncomfortable or is it just me? Am I the only one sweating right now? Okay, glad I wore deodorant. It feels uncomfortable. And church, either we will unite around Jesus Christ, We'll unite around Jesus Christ or we'll scatter around our preferences. Which one sounds Christ-like to you? Which one sounds mature to you? Listen, I want all of you to hear this. The Bible makes it really clear that we are supposed to be a church for all the nations and all the generations. And we cannot do that if we have preference battles. We can't. This church will be white middle class unless we change. It will also be a certain age unless we change. And church, this has to be, listen to me. I'm not saying we need to be a church of all 20-year-olds. Imagine that marriage conference. Like the 25-year-old saying, let me tell you guys what marriage should look like to the 23-year-olds. Right? Listen, I'm begging you people. My senior adults that have been walking with Jesus for 40 or 50 years. I know you're flexing right now. Listen, I need you to hear me say this. I don't want your money. Keep your money. We want you to be a part of this church because there's a generation coming up that needs to see mature, passionate followers of Jesus that will be committed to saying, I don't care about my preferences. I care about Jesus and I care about you. I don't want to guilt you into that. Listen, if you can't handle it, it's okay. That's going to be your decision. But I believe that you're still here because you find Jesus to be more valuable than your music preferences. And I want you to know I see that and I'm happy about it. And I think more importantly, Jesus sees it and he's happy about it. And I want you along for the ride and I want you to pour into young people in a way they never imagined they would be poured into. Young people. Listen, the church isn't about you, and neither is life. We don't have all the answers. Church is about Jesus. And you can tell all the people that are older to shove off because they don't get it. But listen, these buildings and this campus were built on the back of men and women that made a whole lot less money than you and sacrificed a whole lot more than you. They've seen God work in ways you can't even imagine. They've walked through fires you don't even know exist. You think you know marriage problems? Think they haven't tasted that if they've been married for 50, 60 years? I think they got something to offer. Listen, they've seen pain with their kids that we don't even know yet. They've suffered loss. Some of them have gone through things like cancer and they still love Jesus. They've watched loved ones suffer and die slowly and they're still here. We need that. Listen to people. You need that. And if you walk away from that because there's not enough band songs, I'm going to say it bluntly. You need to grow up and you need to find Jesus to be better. He's better than your preferences because one day you're going to be 50 or 60 or 70 or whatever you consider old and your kids are going to like some music that you hate and you're going to have to hand the church off to them too. You better figure out how to consider others better than yourself now. Because you're going to be an old, dead, dying church in 30 years if you don't learn how to hand off. So church, that was real talk for a moment. And here's what I'm saying. I'm not saying just simply that I want us to go together. I'm saying I want us to go with Jesus. I'm saying I want him to taste better than your preferences. That if you got a taste of Jesus, you would give up everything. That he's so good, he makes you rejoice no matter the style of music and no matter the suffering you're experiencing right now. That's the book of Philippians. I want us to be unified not around a building or an address or around the same socioeconomic status or the same background. I want us to be unified around the gospel work of Jesus Christ. I want you to believe that the person that is completely different than you that's in Christ, you have more like with that person than an unsaved person that has everything the same as you but no Jesus. That's what I want you to believe. I want us to be unified around Jesus. I want us to rejoice around Jesus, and nothing else will do as a good substitution.